Hello, and welcome to Openly Gamer Theater's Tower of the Ape, a Savage Worlds Deluxe roleplay drama from the producers of Gamer's Table. Be warned, this production may contain some explicit material that may not be suitable for all audiences.
Velakius.
This is Dan. I'm going to be playing Matadai.
This is Shannon, and I'm playing Lovaisa.
Hi, this is Dave, and I'm playing Ronyos.
Hello, my name is Jason. I'm playing Odored Soractus.
And I'm Sean. I'm playing Mofir.
The hand-cranked overhead fan hardly stirred the air of the rising morning heat as Jamor leaned his thick arm on the lacquered wooden countertop and stared out the open front window. Though there were a few patrons in the bar nursing their drinks, he couldn't help but let his mind wander. The Golden Cat, an alehouse of rather nefarious reputation, was located at the end of a street nicknamed Three Hole Lane by visiting sailors and other transients. The moniker referred to the number of times a stranger was likely to be knifed if caught walking alone. As harsh a sobriquet as it wasn't without its merit. Sultanapur, a city renowned for its flesh markets, was not a place for the weak. Those who foolishly trusted their safety to the Shahzadeh's constabulary were lucky if all they lost was their purse. Many a drunk wanderer ended up in chains and sold on the block to some debased master. Even Yezdegerd, the Turanian king, their own sovereign, avoided Sultanapur. Jamur turned his head and eyed his patrons with disdain. They were all locals, wretched nighttime predators who had recently awoken from sleeping off the previous night's revelry. As much as he hated the scum, he needed their coin. Local fare wasn't his only business, though. Soon, dockworkers and sailors would start filtering in, and then he wouldn't have time to waste on idle thoughts of fancy. He hissed at the slave girl, who quickly ceased her pointless cranking of the fan and hopped off her stool. It was nearly time for the midday winds that met grit and other detritus blowing directly into the front window. As soon as she began closing the shutters, Jamur fetched his tinderbox and lit candles wedged in stubby pewter holders on the cracked wooden tables. The door swung open as he settled himself back behind the bar. He half-heartedly regarded it, expecting the usual sea dogs or dockhands. He couldn't have been further from the truth. A white, blonde-haired woman stood in the doorway. She projected strength without detracting from her beauty. Her attire was as odd as she was. She wore tight buckskin leggings with rawhide laces down both sides that ended in supple leather boots with upturned tops. Her loose tunic flowed with her motion, accentuating the curves of her body without restricting her movement. Most offsetting about her, though, was the vicious-looking axe she carried openly, her right hand gripping the haft just below its bearded head. It was a Northron weapon, well-suited to her. She was of the near-mythic race of barbarians that called the icy lands of Asgard home. Beside her stood a dark-haired man of obvious Zamorian stock, whose smoldering good looks masked the dangerous sparkle in his eye. His dress was obviously inspired by his country of origin, consisting of dark breeches and a loose, open-necked white shirt separated at the waist with a scarlet sash. He moved with the dangerous ease of a panther, took in the room at a glance, and nodded toward a group of tables near the back. Jamur let them settle in before he sent the slave to wait on them. It was just then that the door opened again, and more strangers entered. These two just as queer as the first. Both were men, but vastly different in appearance. The first was a massively built, dark-haired fighting man. Behind him was a man that made Jamur's skin crawl. His racial origin was not clear at first glance, though he closely resembled the dusky-skinned Stygians of the East. He was covered from head to toe in black clothes, and despite the growing heat, wrapped in a black hooded cloak. Most disturbing was his eyes, pale blue, almost white, that bored into Jamur's and caused him to shrink away. He almost felt his soul chill at the sight. Something was afoot. It was far too coincidental that two pairs of odd strangers would appear so suddenly when there hadn't been anyone but regulars for months. Jamur settled his bulk behind the bar and reserved himself to enjoying the diversion from the drollery of his normal life.
I will be at a table just off to the side, quietly drinking.
Lovaisa, where are you?
Be at the table with Ronos.
Okay, so you and Ronos are in an adjacent table.
If Mike is sitting across the table from this guy, uh-huh. I'm going to be at the table sitting right behind the guy so I can listen in and turn around and smoke him if I need to.
Okay, that's fine. Bright light of the midday sun sliced the gloom as the outer door opened. Motes of dust mixed with blue smoke in the brief brilliance. Bearded faces averted their eyes lest they be blinded when the door of the tavern closed and the occupants were thrust into the murk of the flickering candlelight again. The newcomer differed from most of the usual patrons of the pub in that he was very well dressed. Riffraff here were the castoffs and deserters of armies or house guard, sodden scallywags, new to port, and various other dregs that sat bar stools in hopes of drowning themselves in cheap wine. Though his garb was out of place here, the man was not. He strode through the room like a man confident that he was among friends, with no fear that deft fingers would find his purse, nor a sharp shiv would find his ribs. As he crossed the room, he smiled a toothy grin at several who nodded at him or bid him hello. Hand stroking his luxurious pointed black mustache, he spoke to the few in the room that warranted it. The plume of his great brimmed hat bounced as he glided his girth past every table in the establishment before settling on one near the back. Symok looked at the man sitting at the table in smug amusement. At the table was a hard-eyed man whose face was not pleasant to look at. It had seen too many brawls, be they singular or on a larger scale. Scarred lips parted in a half-hearted smile, giving the man an even more unfortunate appearance. His clothes were of fine make, but worn in places as if he were more accustomed to covering them in armor. Symok remained standing as he studied the man. He had earned a reputation among his peers for being a shrewd trader, though it was not his knowledge of trade that gained him this distinction, but his ability to read a man and take advantage of his findings. The man he watched was no Hyrkanian, but a dark-haired Hyborian. His eyes went to the man's thick hands gripping the handle of a half-full jack. A grin, masked by his mustache, touched the corners of his mouth as he decided on his opening tactic.
"It is customary, Lord Durand, that prospective partners share drinks before any business dealings. By not having a drink waiting for me, you are saying that either you believe that we are on equal standing, or that I am beneath you. But you are a foreigner, and I will overlook this breach of etiquette."
Sorry, what language are we speaking?
You speak Hyrkanian?
I do.
Okay, speaking Hyrkanian.
Ronos is translating for me, right?
It would be very obvious if everything that is said is completely... True. So maybe just pertinent things.
Sneer at the guy's mention of my breach of his cultural traditions. Shrug it off, and, you know, we're speaking in Hyrkanian, of course. "Oh, I'm sorry, I was mildly distracted," motioning to the table nearby. Okay. And mention the blonde.
All right,
woman.
He kind of turns his head sideways and sees.
"Please, Lord Durand, I'm not interested in your fancies. The girl is exotic, yes, but unwashed Cretans are no excuse for letting your mind stray from the business at hand."
"As you will."
He just called us Cretans.
Oh, axe is out.
Blow the whole deal, woman.
I need a boat, and I needed a guide.
What is your destination?
Does your captain know the Viliette well?
His eyes roll as if he's bored with the conversation already.
I have been sailing the Viliette all of my life. I am intimately familiar with all of her seaports and bays. So please, tell me your destination so we can agree on a cost. Are you shipping goods? Transporting personnel?
Passengers.
You're asking to be passengers on my ship. Very well.
And my destination is my business until I am actually set foot on the deck of your ship.
I must inform you that I have a full complement of stock aboard with a charter that dictates that I take the wretches north. If you are going north...
I do not mind sharing the ship if it is going north.
He's got a boat full of slaves, man.
I know I'm going north that much because it's Sultanapur in the south.
Sultanapur is
so
the...
So there's only one way to go.
Yeah, there's only one way to go. I mean, Sultanapur is located more north than most of the other ports on the Viliette.
Okay. So him saying going north
means that he's going into uncharted areas or right. Just like...
Yeah, that don't seem to faze me.
Very well. However convenient my route may be for you, the fact remains that I have need of your destination. I am not in the business of setting down in some mysterious port that imperils my craft, crew, or cargo. That said, I am not an unreasonable man. If you're willing to pay for my trust, we can continue this line of bargaining.
I am of House Durand from Aquilonia. I am of upstanding...
This colloquy is taking place solely because I know of your family and respect its business reputation.
I look at Lovayasa. We may need to kill this man and take his boat.
If we kill him, how will we run the boat?
I didn't say it was a perfect plan.
Just say the word, I'm ready.
Simply telling me your destination will move this negotiation along to finalization.
I'm not sure I know the destination. I don't have a name.
Perhaps your story, then.
This is precisely why I put myself at a different table. I want to make Mike tell the story.
I snap my fingers. Valak, come and sit.
Fucking jack off.
Lord Durand, your man is welcome to join us if you wish it.
I am not his man, Captain.
Refill my drink. And then his drink.
Since they seem to be stuttering, I break in and I say, perhaps my story is easier.
All right, he turns and looks at you, and what are you speaking to him in?
Oh, does he speak Zamorian?
Of course.
Okay.
So you start speaking to him in Zamorian, and then he looks at Ronios.
Let us put an end to this folly. Those invested in this dealing need to make themselves known, lest I withdraw entirely and leave you here in Sultanapur to your own talents. And judging by our current situation, you are in need of considerable aid in that regard. If there is a tale to be told, I suggest someone tells it.
I'm looking for my father.
Your father? I see.
All we know is he was on a ship with Milos going north.
At the mention of Milos, he straightens a little bit.
Milos? You seek Milos?
Yes.
Do you intend him harm?
No. Maybe.
The answer is yes. We do.
Very much yes.
He squints.
And I can tell that you have a grudge against Milos, yes?
Grudge? No. Milos is a dog. I understand the nature of business. He, however, is a scoundrel and a cheat. If he were not the richest trader of flesh on the inner sea, I would have nothing to do with him.
Symok's eyes narrow as he licks his dry lips and straightens his mustache with thick, ringed fingers.
Milos has been employing every slaver on the Viliette for some mysterious benefactor. This new patron pays handsomely for healthy units, and my hold carries stock intended for him.
What if I told you that we could get you your money, and he would never give you trouble again?
You intend to rid us of Milos's influence.
He seems not to notice the waitress appear at his elbow and place a fine-stemmed wine glass before him. Suddenly his eyes brighten and shift from one corner of the room to the other.
The risk I take is considerable. If I aid your purpose, and you fail, my business will be put in jeopardy and my reputation ruined. I would need assurances from you, regardless of your success.
I actually take out some gems and I lay them out on the table.
He covers them with a handkerchief, because he doesn't want everybody in the world to see this. When he brings the handkerchief back, the gems are gone.
Ha! It is done! Speak to no one of our contract.
I've never even met you.
If anyone asks, you didn't know of our plans.
This whole conversation would have been so much easier if you had waited till I was staying on the deck of your ship.
And we could have negotiated first the price light. A bit, Ronios.
Now, for a drink.
The slender brown barmaid appears with a fresh bottle of wine and begins pouring.
That's dawn we will save. Your lord knows the birthing of the Kamar.
Glasses are raised in salute, and the bargain is struck.
I don't do that anymore. Last time I drank with someone, I ended up in a bed late.
I will watch you.
With business concluded, Symok smiles broadly and looks over everyone before lowering his voice conspiratorially.
traveling north from here, seeking Milos. You seek his island.
Yes.
I have delivered there in the past.
Knew it.
You take us to that island?
I will, but be wary. That island is home of pure diabolism. It lays in the shadow of a tower rooted in hell itself. The Tower of the Ape.
Is this a dangerous place?
Dangerous? Just viewing it has blasted men's souls. It is said that it is the remnants of some ancient civilization that called the northern hills of the Viliette home, and that some dark sorcerer from the south awoke nameless horrors from the depths within the ruins where the tower now stands. It is where he awaits the destruction of the world. At night, strange beings roam the lands beneath the tower. None have seen them clearly and lived. They are blasphemous, anthropomorphic devils disgorged from the pits beneath the tower. Brilliant slices through the gloom again. This time, a much smaller form is silhouetted by the open entryway. Stepping in and closing the door behind her is a girl, her dark hair gathered up on the crown of her head in intricate ringlets by a golden clasp. Her attire is more suited to a Turanian noble's court than a working man's tavern. She scans the faces of the crowd who sit in stunned silence at the sight of a noble child in their midst. Her face brightens as she glimpses the group gathered in the back and makes her way towards them. As she nears, her pace quickens until she bounds into Lovaisa's arms.
Oh, I am so happy to see you.
I greet her very warmly.
The girl rests her head on your thick shoulder.
My lady was told that you were here. She wishes to see you right away.
Her head rises and her face brightens as she meets your gaze with an innocent intensity.
It's about Mad Hedai. He was here.
He was? I thought he had business. I thought he was going away.
He was here not 10 days ago, and left a message for you with my lady.
Take me to her. I'm sorry, Captain Symok. I'll see you at morning light.
Oh, very well. Until then.
Symok's eyes narrow in appreciation of the leaping woman.
She is quite a rare specimen.
His twitching mouth beneath his elegant mustache hardly contains his lurid thoughts.
A rare treasure indeed.
Yes, yes. Let's hope she is not late.
White pain lanced through his head as waves of nausea caused him to lay his head back down. He licked his lips and tasted the metallic tang of blood. His mouth was so dry he couldn't spit out the grit that coated his teeth and tongue. Instinctively, he reached a hand to his throbbing head. He could feel the viscous clotted blood that matted the hair and beard of his left side. He attempted opening his eyes again and quickly regretted it.
You slept through a fight.
Choking back the bile building in his throat, he laboriously raised himself onto his elbow. The sun was high in the sky, though a storm seemed to be building, judging by the frequency of swift clouds obscuring it. He tried to pry the matted hair from his left eye, but quickly abandoned the effort. He must have lain in his own blood long enough for the hair to thoroughly adhere to his face. Matted Eye took stock of his surroundings.
You got knocked the fuck out.
I rubbed my chin.
Okay.
Has it been a day or longer?
It's been...
I'm not sure that would help you.
Got stubble up top.
That's a long-ass beard from that picture you got.
Yeah, and your face is crusted with blood. You feel the pangs of hunger, so it's probably been a day. Scattered about him and littering the loam like fallen leaves lay the fallen. Sunlight glinting dazzlingly from burnished helms, broken links of mail, and gore-spattered breastplates. Broken weapons mingled with broken bodies of men and beasts in pools of cooling crimson. Of the 500 heavy lancers the envoy left Sultanapur with, as far as he could tell, none lived. Mixed with the corpses of his countrymen were others, though most were Hyrkanian like himself. Some of them were of other races as well. They were all Kozaks, lawless barbarians who frequently harried the northern forces of Turan, It was not uncommon for a company of them to attack a small group of Terranians, but they rarely tested a cavalcade of cataphracts. He and his companions must have been badly outnumbered. The tenderness to the crown of his head concerned him. Whoever dashed him narrowly missed crushing his skull. He was fortunate that a headache and a bit of lost memory was all he suffered. He did remember being on a mission for Nikifor, the son of Prince Dirixis, the Shahzadeh of Sultanapur. The prince had assigned an agent of the crown, Kai Sharan, to lead the force. It was a highly irregular traveling party, but the circumstances of the mission were abnormal. It involved the ransoming of a Turanian general, and his head whipped around as he suddenly remembered his charge, a prisoner who called himself Strom, a Kozak headman whose return was part of a ransom being paid to those lawless brigands. He didn't stop himself in time and nearly collapsed as vertigo assailed him again. Mad-Eye closed his eyes and forced himself to stand. He scanned the battlefield with a purpose and sighed heavily as his good eye settled on a large wooden cart lying on its side. It looked as though the team had broken their harness and the cart careened over into a small gully. He staggered towards it. Luckily, the heavy wooden door affixed to the back still appeared to be fastened. With a wavering hand, Mad-Eye tugged the leather thong from around his neck, and his fingers found the brass key that was safely secured under his boiled leather corselet and undershirt. The key turned in the thick, oiled lock on the door, which the Hyrkanian let fall into the dust at his feet, and the door opened slightly. The hinges had been damaged from the impact of the cart striking the packed earth of the dry gully, and required considerable effort to move. After what seemed a lifetime, Mad-Eye peered into the open doorway. Were it not for his disorientation, the sight that greeted him would have seemed comical. A giant of a man hung suspended from the thick wooden wall of the cart that now served as its ceiling. He hung by a stout steel chain that was linked to a metal clamp around his waist. His limbs were also chained, wrists and ankles. Until his heavily muscled bull neck turned his shaggy-haired head, Mad-Eye couldn't tell if the prisoner was still alive. He didn't realize that he had been holding his breath until he blew it out in relief. In the gloom of the cart, the giant stared back at the bonded.
I thought everyone was dead.
Indeed. I'll unlock the door to the cart, put the key in his hand. Oh, no, he can't do that.
So. He's like, fuck, asshole. What a douchebag.
Hang it on his neck.
I'll kind of look at him for a minute and just kind of an unspoken agreement between the two of us, like, I'm going to let you out.
And I would totally speak that if I
and you are not going to kill me. No, it's not. It's fine. This is about loyalty. It's about honor and doing the right thing. And
okay.
And I'll unlock him. Right. I'll hand him, like, my water skin that I have with me. And
he drinks.
I'll leave the cage and I'll kind of survey around. Okay. Maybe get up on top of it. And
all right, you get up on top.
I'm still looking for Odrid. And
go ahead and make a notice check.
5 and 4.
So you stand up on the cart and you hear him unlocking himself and then finally comes free and crawls out of the back. Stands up and starts stretching.
Looks even more better.
You had better see to that head wound.
The giant walks over to Mad-Eye and thumbs aside the matted hair while pouring some water on his wound.
Just a split scalp, likely from whatever nearly brained you. You're lucky it didn't crush your skull.
I don't know what happened. Did this happen during the night?
All you remember is traveling, you heard, like, horns, and you're like, uh-oh, and then that's it. That's all you remember.
That's pretty much how it works.
Strom is on one knee now as he's stretched, and he's finished your water skin.
Where is my brother?
Your what?
Odrid.
I smile, and I kind of nod. I wondered what you two were conspiring about.
Shrugs.
I do not know.
And he stands up, and he looks around.
If I know Odrid, though, and if he is alive, I know where he's headed.
It seems we are too late for the arranged meeting.
I would say. I have to get you home.
All right, he smiles.
Fortunate for you, these men were not of my company and didn't know that I was chained in that infernal caged cart. If they had, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
I would say.
He starts looking around.
How well do you track, bonded?
I mean, that's my job.
Fair.
Fair to middling.
I get my bearings, you know, where's north, where.
Do you have tracking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so go ahead and make a tracking check.
Okay. One success, right? Look at target number 4,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
His tracking's better than mine.
It's D10.
Mad-Eye kneels next to the mangled Kozaki corpse. For a moment, he turns his head to the side and inspects the ground, then rises and lopes off towards the lapping sound of a lazy river. Cresting the small hill face leading to the water's edge, he stops. Lying amid a circle of butchered men is a nearly naked man with the handles of axes in each hand. His bare feet and lower legs are submerged beneath the crimson river.
He's clearly dead.
He's clearly dead. Gotta leave him behind. Leave him here.
I'll sprint over there to him, kind of get him out of the river, and I don't know. I don't have any. I have survival. I don't know.
You hear some giggling
from
just down the river.
Nah. It's like I look to Strom. It's like I believe that would be your brother's friend, Mofir.
He kneels down next to Audrey. He looks at him. He says,
"He will live. Someone has dashed him as you were. He's lost a lot of blood from this shoulder wound, though."
Take a bandage and I'll bandage his head up.
Do you have healing at all?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I know to use a clean bandage.
Right.
That's about it.
By the smell of it, he's beginning to fester. It needs tending before the infection spreads. My company should be camped within a few hours' ride from here. We should take him there.
I look him up and down. I wouldn't be so cruel to a horse as to put you on one.
He smiles and nods.
One of those dead Turanian dog stallions would suit me fine.
Well, I believe you look strong enough we can probably right the cart. Is the cart still serviceable if we just push it up?
It is. You would make more time riding regular, though.
I say, you tend to your brother. I will find the biggest live horse that I can possibly find for this guy.
That's fine. Water is unceremoniously dashed into Audrey's shoulder and face, eliciting a sputtering, woozy consciousness followed by an outburst of violent action, like that of a wounded tiger. Strom pounces and grabs the younger man's head with both hands, yelling at him in a guttural tongue of the savages who dwell beyond the western Aquilonian border. Otterid's eyes clear as he meets his brother's, and he replies in Pictish.
What happened?
The column was attacked. Do you remember?
Yes. Killed lots of men. Trying to get to you.
Lies.
Lots of men. I think I may have killed a few of our own.
You are stricken with the red rage. I've seen it before.
This is true. Something I learned amongst the people. How did it end up here in the river?
I do not know. Perhaps your Zamorian friend can tell you.
Strom points to a large rock shading the nearby bank of the river, under which squats Mofir, the wild-eyed Zamorian mystic.
I think he's bathing himself.
In mud. No, he's relieving himself in the river. Downstream, thankfully.
I gather up rations and
anything
that I can, and a few good horses, a couple spares, and I say we make haste before raiders come.
All right.
Scavenge. I look for the prince's liaison.
Kaishuran?
Kaishuran.
Oh, I forgot about him.
Gone. No body, nothing.
Oh.
Why do I feel unsurprised by this?
I'm thinking he's a hostage.
No. I am normally enough. I would have completed the mission. There was no need for a liaison. He came for other purposes.
Strom eyes Matted Eye cautiously and then turns his attention to saddling his new stallion. In the Pictish tongue, he mutters to Odred as the younger man uncomfortably stares at his new horse. As the giant speaks, Odred's eyes flick to Matted Eye. A shadow of a smile touches Strom's lips, a smile that is not mirrored in his eyes.
You guys not speaking in Pictish, can we please let's iron that out now?
Right. He switches to the Aquilonian tongue, allowing Matted Eye to understand.
Does this suit you better, bonded?
Can you speak Aquilonian? Yes, you do.
That's his actual native tongue.
Been a long time.
Wonderful. And Mofir.
Yes.
I stumble over the words.
Are you okay?
Yes. Me and mother
Does
are
he
just
look
fine.
Like he's like totally uninjured.
Yeah, like no one touched
Squeaky
him.
Squeaky clean.
Yeah. He's just been sitting on the side of the river waiting for Otter to wake up.
Did you drag me to the river?
No, mother did.
Yes.
Clearly. Good to have mother on your side.
The Turanian stallion groans as the giant mounts, then the four men head west, as clouds of black wings descend upon the grim field of slaughter. Matted Eye, Odred, Mofir, and Strom slowly guide their steeds over the open steppe in an uneasy silence. Matted Eye and Mofir ride well ahead of the others, affording the brothers a modicum of privacy, though for several hours the privacy was unneeded. His molded topknot swaying with the motion of the horse's gait, Odred finally broke the silence with a clearing of his throat, and he speaks in Pictish.
Was it you that set me free?
Yes, I freed you and accepted the traitor's title in your stead.
What do you mean?
The Pictish devils who adopted you abandoned you to your fate the night Zogar Sag died, retreating across Black River and leaving you unconscious where you fell at the wall.
This is true.
Yeah, it still astounds me that you were recognized since it had been 15 years since you were last seen in Velitrium as Odorad Seractus. Gone native. A traitor to your people.
I shake my head.
But I knew the truth, and I couldn't let them hang you. But I have always protected you, haven't I, Ardred? That is the burden of an older brother.
Why are we taking you to the Kozaks?
They are my people now. Does it surprise you that I would come all the way out here? The options for a deserter are limited.
You had to desert after you let me go?
As I said, I was branded a traitor. My fate was sealed when I made my escape and was forced to slay the guard sergeant.
So now you're a leader amongst the Kozaks?
I am. I have earned their trust and they mine. The Kozaks value strength and elevate a man's status based on his fighting heart, unlike the titles bestowed on the soft, pampered lords of the Western lands.
So where we're taking you is a safe place for both of us.
Yes, as safe as any, considering.
Ardred nods to Matadai, who turns his head in the brother's direction, taking note of the conversation, though he does not speak the tongue.
Are our parents still alive?
Father died at Fort Tusklin shortly after I arrived in the Westermark. When I traveled through Gundolin on my way out here, I visited Mother's grave. She died 3 years ago, or so I was told.
You know, when I was captured by the Picts, I was coming to try and serve with you.
I know. When I learned that you disappeared in Kanajohara, I searched for you. Then, all those years later, when I heard that you had been found, I knew what had to have happened to you, what became of you. I had to see for myself.
They ride for a time, listening to the clomp of the hooves on the loam. With every step, Odred's eyes grow more and more stern, his face a mask of somber conviction.
I've been told that you know where I can find a man called Dardo.
A smile touches the corner of his lips, and he rests his chin on his massive scarred chest.
I know him very well. A year ago, a group of slaves escaped their Turanian master and asked to join my company. Soon afterward, Dardo arrived and asked to join as well. The slaves I took in told me that Dardo was the one who had freed them from their master. But I knew him of old, though he did not know my face. I know what he did to you, to your wife.
He's in your company? He's under your command?
I knew that if I kept him close, you would come for him.
Is he still alive?
When I was last with my company, he was.
You'll take me to him, and you'll let me do what I need to do?
I swear it.
Silence again descends like a blanket over them, until Strahm breaks it.
The Shaheen Belush that travels with you. What do you know of him?
He's a good man.
It is said that the bonded cannot be corrupted. No amount of bribe or torture can divert them from their task. His loyalty to his Turanian masters is absolute. Can he be trusted?
Well, without question. I've been with him for over a year. Of all the men I've met in the so-called civilized lands, he's the most honorable.
Yeah. Has he given his vow to see me safely delivered to my company?
He has. I was there when he made the vow.
Very well.
His head slightly nods in acceptance of the affirmation of Matadai's character, and after a moment's contemplation, he sniffs and closes his eyes.
And this is a Morian that travels with you. What of him?
He's insane.
Silence weighs heavy for a span before he speaks again.
There is one other that I've seen, in addition to the soldiers. Hawk-nosed Hyrcanian with a blue turban.
He's the prince's man.
He works for Dorixis. That clarifies things. I have seen him before.
Really? Where?
In the company of Dardo. He has met with him on occasion. I was told that he was a merchant contact of Dardo's.
Really?
But it was a weak lie.
Thank you, brother.
Strahm smiles grimly as Odred's mount picks up pace, the younger man riding to join up with his companions, who have taken great interest in his dealings with the Kozak, and watch over their shoulders as he approaches.
Quite the conversationalist.
It's been a long time since I've heard my native tongue.
That's not your native tongue.
It is to me. I've spent it more than half my life speaking.
I heard mention of Dardo.
Yes, I asked him about Dardo.
And?
He said,
share?
He said Dardo was in his company. He knows him well.
It's not very useful. Oh, and he knows him well?
Yes.
Can he take us to him?
He said he would take me to him. If we see him safely, he would take me to him.
I don't see any problem with that.
No.
All is well.
Bright sunshine and the sounds of bustling commerce assail you as you step from the dark confines of the tavern. Lalika takes your hand, dragging you with youthful exuberance through the crowded streets of Sultanapur. She scarcely notices the trains of wretches bound with chains shuffling under the glare of their overseer. The snap of his whip, a telltale sign of enforced urgency.
Madhede, I only stayed in Sultanapur for a short time. He briefly visited my lady, long enough to give her the message she now bears for you. He left in the company of the oddly painted savage, the strange one who speaks to his rocks in a compliment of His Majesty's finest horsemen. They paraded out of the city to a splendid fanfare.
I'm glad it sounds like he's doing something important.
A special mission for the prince, or so I've heard.
Passing under a grand, intricately graven, triumphal arch, Lalika pauses in the shade to sip from a bubbling fountain set into one of the piers. Beside it stands a mail-clad guard whose eyes bore into you with disdain from beneath his gilt-work spiral helm. When she finishes, he shifts the broad head of his spear to prevent anyone else from drinking. Beyond the threshold of the arch, the avenues widen, where white paves and marble structures mark the passage into the noble district. Pleasant salt tang of the harbor supplants the stench of the lower quarters thanks to a gentle offshore breeze, and the sounds of despair, so prominent a few feet before, seem a distant memory. At the far end of the long, broad avenue stands the golden domed palace of Deryxis, the Shahzadeh of Sultanapur. The manicured gardens ringing it easily rival any surrounding King Yezdegerd's Alcazars to the south. Turning towards the western wing of the palace and traversing a white marble bridge cutting across a walled section of the garden, Lalika slows her pace long enough to marvel at white furred tiger cubs beneath the span, frolicking in the low-cut sward under the close supervision of their mother. Cool ocean breeze blows through open windows and rejuvenates you as you enter the apartments of Prince Nikephor, eldest son of Deryxis. The opulent apartments evoke vivid memories of your last dealing with this nobleborn. The dark streets of the Zamorin City of Thieves, a vile spider cult, and the bound form of Nadia, the dancing girl, naked on the altar. Richly dressed servants make way for you as you enter the back hall of the wing. High arched ribbed ceilings are adorned with murals depicting the grandeur of House Deryxis. The golden floor, evenly divided with a lush crimson carpet, is etched with a flowing script describing the magnificence of the prince's line. Golden-helmed guards open ivory and gold doors leading into a vast domed chamber. Your booted feet sink into thick carpets as you enter, and you are overwhelmed by a buffet of scents. Flowery perfume mixed with acrid smoke and unwashed bodies. Lounging like a clouder of felines on pillows of velvet and satin, a score of sensuous concubines look at you and Lalika in idle fascination before turning back to their individual fancies. When they bother to speak, the bubbling of a fountain amid the large bath drowns out the low-toned voices of the women. Two pairs of large ebon-skinned guards stand beside the doors of the room, showing no interest in the nearly naked, supple forms lazing before them. Lalika pulls your hand as you hesitate.
Come, Northrun. Have you never seen a Seraglio before?
Realizing that you may not have ever been in a place like this before, Lalika gives you a smile.
My lady says that, unlike anywhere else in the palace, you can be yourself here.
She makes her way towards the far pair of golden doors.
That is because there are no men allowed in the Princess Seraglio.
Broad, dark hands open the doors for you as you near, and Lalika waves dismissively at them.
Except for these eunuchs.
Cheek is up.
Yeah, you have no clue what she's talking about, or at least...
Nothing is up with the eunuch.
You have a very vague concept of what is going on. I mean, you've been in civilization for a year now. Some of the nuances, you know.
Seraglio, I knew to apologize to the captain when I left, but I don't.
Yeah, so you just think it's where a bunch of women live.
Okay.
The hall beyond bears the same extravagance as the rest of the apartment, and Lalika leads you towards another golden door. The guards standing vigil there are identical to the ones in the previous room, with the exception of their blue silk turbans. They stand with their hands resting on hilts of flaring two-handed scimitars. Her head turns slightly as if something is amiss, but before she does, a scream peals from beyond the door.
What's happening? What's in there?
That is my lady's room!
Okay, so I'm just gonna barge in.
As you approach,
axes blazing.
The two eunuchs take one step to the side, and they're both standing right in the doorway.
What's happening in there?
They look straight ahead. They are not engaging you at all.
Something's wrong. Oh, Lovaisa, she's being hurt.
Lalika, is there another way in? A way around?
I do not know. Oh, please, Lovaisa, please.
And you hear a scuffle, and something's going on in there, and she screams again.
I'm going to take out the guards.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm betting she's just not in there with a eunuch. One of those fellas ain't a eunuch.
You would not have your weapons with you. You would have had to probably leave them with your friends.
Would I still have? Because I have knives.
You can have your knife. Yes.
Four throwing knives
on your belt. Yes, you could have those. You could just couldn't have like a major.
But I wouldn't have my axe.
You wouldn't have your axe. Your axe would have to be like with Ronios or somebody. I wouldn't give it to him. He'd end up selling it or pocketing it or something.
Probably, yes.
Yes, you have your knives. Then they have big scimitars.
Lovaisa snarls at the ebon-skinned giants before her and rests her hands on the hilts of two of her thin-bladed Zamorian throwing knives lining her thick belt. Hard black eyes, like chips of obsidian, stare straight ahead. It is plain by their demeanor that the cries for help beyond the guiltwork door did not concern the guards. They stand motionless before the chambers of Nikifor's favorite concubine, with the points of their wide-bladed scimitars thrust into the thick, rich carpet of the hallway. They pay no heed to the pale-haired woman as a guttural growl rumbles in her throat, nor do they concern themselves with the curly-haired child crying and tugging at the woman's hip. Initiative?
Let's do this.
Jack, 4. You go first.
Before I draw my knife, I'm going to try and intimidate them. I'm going to use former gladiator, so if I succeed in the intimidate, I get two melee attacks.
Roll it up.
4.
You win.
Ymir!
One of the eunuchs starts with the outburst from the woman and turns to face her. Though he doesn't seem to understand her words, he was clearly startled to hear such rage ejaculate from such a lovely form.
5.
Their parry is 6. So you can Benny it if it's that important to you.
I'll get him. I'll get him next round.
With the quickness of a jungle cat, Loveza draws one of her keen-edged blades from its sheath and narrowly misses the slack-jawed guard's throat, fate causing him to be knocked back by his partner's elbow as the unshaken one springs to action, bringing his own heavy blade to bear. The blade of the scimitar hums as it falls in a murderous arc. Were it not for her superior reflexes, she surely would have been hewed from shoulder to belly by the thick-armed giant's weapon. But she was no water-kneed daughter of civilization. She was Aesir. The women of her village fought as fiercely as any man. She had been besting brutes bigger than these devils from the time she could wield a weapon. A ring of steel and the eunuch's blade sinks inches deep into the carpeting and the stone floor beneath. Taking advantage of the distraction, Lalika dodges past the tree trunk legs of the ebon men, turns the latch of the door, and rushes into the room beyond, leaving the door open, affording Loveisa the opportunity to see inside the opulent bedchamber. Beyond the open door and the eunuch guards is a richly dressed man standing over a dainty gold-haired woman. His thick brown hands engulf her neck, and he is squeezing the life from her. An inhuman growl emits from his throat as he pushes her down on the plush divan, his knee propped beside her for leverage. The girl's feet kick spasmodically in a vain effort to unseat him. Lalika lies unmoving on the floor beside him, the victim of a buffet of the man's fist.
Yeah.
New initiative. 10 for you. 10 for me. Diamonds. I have to roll to see if the first one comes out of his shaking, because you intimidated him, so he's shaking. Mm. So his spirit is a d6. He is still shaking, so he's still like, what's going on? Why is this woman screaming? Why did she try and cut me? The other one takes a swipe at you with his scimitar again. 4 is a miss.
And I get 2 attacks now.
Yes.
So I'm going to take a stab at each one. A 7, a 3, and a 4.
The 7 hits. It's straight up damage.
11.
He's shaking. So now both of them are shaking.
Do I recognize the man?
No.
Okay. I shout out the eunuchs and I'm, turn around! Look, this is who you're supposed to be protecting. Do they pay attention to me?
It's a new initiative. 9 for you. 5 for me.
I'm going to try and go around them.
The Aesir spins past the groping hands of the stunned guards and she runs into the room. She rushes behind the richly dressed man and coils her left arm around his neck, placing the knife in her other hand to his throat just under his ear. Stricken by bloodlust, the robust man ignores the woman on his back, intent on the one he is strangling. Words of Hyrcanian growled through his gritted teeth, words that meant nothing to the ears of the barbarian who never picked it up despite her travels through these lands. Regaining their composure, the eunuchs barrel into the room with scimitars raised, spreading out, staying their attacks on the woman lest they strike the man she holds before her.
Initiatives.
5. King.
Ooh.
They swing at you again, and the guy's trying to break your hold, so. Loveisa winces in pain as one of the ebon giants fletches the point of his weapon in her thigh. Using her distraction as an opening, the robed man swats at her with a wild swing of his hand, breaking her hold on him. He doubles his effort, strangling the blue-faced former dancing girl below him, trusting in his guards to handle the savage interrupting him from his task.
You better go after the weak guy. Try to finish him off fast.
What's in the room? Is there any way that I can grab Lalika and Nadia and get out of the room?
You would have to wrench Nadia out of his grasp, and there is a window.
I'm going to attack this guy. I'm going to try and get his hand off of her.
Lovisa places a booted foot on the chest of the rogue man, grabs Nadia by the shoulders, and heaves with all of her might.
8.
He got a 5, so you disarm it. The manicured nails of the nobleman's hands gouge crimson grooves along the alabaster flesh of the concubine's throat and bare breasts as the Aesir wrenches the girl from his grasp. The robust robed figure careens backward and sprawls onto the floor between the two giant guards, who stare in shock seeing their master lying at their feet. In a moment of confusion, they abandon their attack and bend to help the fallen noble, who begins sputtering with rage.
Angrily, he brushes their meaty hands away and growls a command in Hyrkanian.
I turn to Lalika and I say, can you jump? Can you jump with us?
She's sprawled out on the ground.
Oh, geez. I have to grab her, too.
You can't grab her and the other girl and have a dagger in your hand.
Oh, geez.
Just take another round.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? You've got Nadia.
Grabbing Nadia and moving towards Lalika in like sort of a protective stance for now.
So you're standing over?
Yeah. And I guess I still have my dagger,
your dagger in hand. Okay. 10 for you. 9 for me. Bending over to grab the unconscious form of little Lalika, Lovesa narrowly avoids the clumsy swipes of the rattled guardsman's heavy blades.
I'm going to throw my knife at the silk robe guy.
All right, roll your throwing.
Throwing is a D10.
There you go.
It's very convenient and having D6. Everything at a
everything
D10.
Everything at a D10, yes.
Oh, 6 explodes. 8.
8 is a raise on him.
Excellent.
And add it all together.
Total of 14.
A quick flick of her hand, and the leather-wrapped hilt of her knife stands out from the rich-robed noble's throat. His eyes dilate in surprise, mouth working in silent shock. Then he collapses, hands attempting to hold the crimson torrent coming from his neck. New initiative. 8 for you, 2 for me.
Yes! Grabbing Lalika, jumping out the window.
Grabbing the little girl with her free hand, Lovaisa leaps backwards through the open window, balances herself on the banister of the wide balcony, and then drops to the garden below. Not wanting to linger in the palace grounds longer than necessary, she runs. A girl over each broad shoulder, she hears high-pitched yelling coming from the open window behind her. As evening closes on Sultanapur, Lovaisa lopes across the manicured lawn toward the low palace wall and the city beyond. Doubtless the man she killed was of some importance, and it won't take long for the prince to set some dogs at her heels. With luck, she might find a place to hide and make it to the dock and safety before morning. For listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Tower of the Ape. Please check for further episodes on our website, gamerstable.com. Any use of this production for commercial purposes is prohibited. Written credit for music and other properties used in this production can be found on this episode's dedicated webpage. Conan is the property of Conan Properties International, who have graciously allowed us to make this production. Savage Worlds Deluxe is the property of Pinnacle Entertainment Group. Openly Gamer Theater and Gamers Table are trademark properties of Side Tangent Productions.